You're listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Spirit of the Waldorf School, lectures surrounding the founding of the first Waldorf School in Stuttgart in 1919. Lecture 2 is entitled The Spirit of the Waldorf School, given in Stuttgart on August 31st, 1919. Last week, I attempted to explain various aspects of the basis of the Waldorf School. I have already pointed out that this school did not appear out of the blue, that we must consider it in the context of modern education. However, we may put into the current stream of education only what conforms with our goals and our perceptions. If we look further, however, we can see that shifts emerge during these major stages of life. We see, for example, that a clear shift occurs around 3 years of age, in the period between birth and the change of teeth, when children develop for the first time a clear feeling of their own selves. In later life, that event marks the earliest point they can remember. Earlier experiences recede into the sleep of childhood. Much else appears around the same time in the development of the child, so we can say that although the child is essentially an imitator in the first 7 years of life, there is a turning point around the middle of this period that must be considered in early child rearing. Two important phases lie in the period between the change of teeth and sexual maturity, that is, during that time in the child's life when elementary education takes place. When the child approaches approximately 7 years of age, those who are able will observe a great change in the child's development. In the first 7 years of life, the child is an imitator. Children tend toward a feeling for authority after the change of teeth, but some earlier desires to imitate remain. Thus, until the age of 9, the need to imitate their surroundings continues, but now it is mixed with the need to allow authority to take effect. If we observe which capacities in the child's life arise out of the depths of human nature, then we find, as I said, I can merely touch upon these things today, through further consideration and observation, that the capacities that appear in this period, between 7 and 9 years of age, must be used to teach the child what naturally occurs as the beginnings of reading and writing. We should use these beginnings in the instruction of reading and writing, so that only what is in harmony with the need to imitate and the need for authority is called upon. If we are artists in educating, and can work on the one hand with the subject material and on the other hand with the emerging need for authority and the receding need to imitate, so that all of it harmonizes, then we create something in the child that has lasting power throughout life until death. We develop something that cannot be made up later, because each stage of life develops its own capacities. Certainly you can say that many teachers have instinctively oriented themselves according to such laws. That is true, but it will not suffice in the future, for in the future such things must be raised to consciousness. Around the age of 9, everything that enables the child to go beyond people into an understanding of nature begins to develop. Before this time, the child is not very well suited to understand nature as such. We could say that until the age of 9, the child is well suited to observe the world in a moralizing manner. The teacher must meet this moralizing need of the child without becoming pedantic. Certainly many teachers already act instinctively in this area. If you examine the didactic instructions of the present, which should tend to relate the subject matter to human nature, then you could be driven to despair. A certain correct instinct is there, but these instructions are so narrow-minded and banal that they dreadfully harm the developing child. We could do well at this stage if we consider, for instance, animals or plants, in a way such that a certain moralizing appears. For example, you can bring fables to children in a way that helps them to understand the animal world. You should be careful not to bring such pablum during the main lesson as is so often done. Above all, you should take care not to tell a story to the children and then to follow it with all kinds of explanations. You destroy everything you want to achieve through telling the story by following it with interpretations. Children want to take stories in through feeling. Without outwardly showing it, they are dreadfully affected in their innermost being if they must listen afterward to the often quite boring explanations. What should we do in the situation if we do not want to go into the real details of the art of storytelling? We might say, quote, "Leave out the explanation and simply tell the children the story," close quote. Fine. Then the children will not understand the story and will surely not enjoy it if they do not understand it. If we want to speak Chinese to people, we must first teach them Chinese. Otherwise, they cannot have the right relationship to what we tell them in Chinese. Thus, we gain nothing by saying, quote, "Leave out the explanations," close quote. You must try to provide an explanation first. When you want to tell the children a story such as the wolf and the lamb, simply speak with the children about the wolf's and the lamb's characteristics. We could also apply this to plant life. As much as possible, speak of these characteristics in relationship to people. Gather everything that you feel will help the children form pictures and feelings that will then resonate when you read the story. If, in an exciting preliminary talk, you offer what you would give afterward as an explanation, then you do not kill the sensations as you would in giving that explanation afterward. On the contrary, you enliven them. If the children have first heard what the teacher has to say about the wolf and the lamb, then their sensations will be all the more lively, and they will have all the more delight in the story. Everything that is necessary for understanding should happen beforehand. The children should not hear the story first. When they hear the story, you must bring them to the heights of their souls for them to understand it. This process must conclude in reading the story, telling the tale, doing nothing more than allowing the children's sensations, already evoked, to take their course. You must allow the children to take their feelings home. Until the age of 9, it is necessary to form the instruction in this way, to relate everything to people. If we have the sensitivity to observe the transition that occurs around 9 years of age, we will know that then the child is first capable of going out into the world of nature. However, the child still relates nature to people. If we describe nature without any relationship to people, it is not yet comprehensible to the 9-year-old child. We only deceive ourselves if we believe that the children understand the conventional descriptions offered as instruction in natural science. We must, of course, take up the study of nature when a child reaches 9 years of age. But we must always relate it to people, particularly in the study of nature. We should not begin with the idea of nature as something external to humans, but always begin with humanity itself. We should always put people in the center. Let us assume that we want a child older than 9 to understand the difference between lower animals, higher animals, and people. Then we begin with people. We compare the lower animals with the human. We compare the higher animals with the human. If we have described the human in terms of form, in terms of daily tasks, then we can apply what we know about humans to the lower and higher animals. The child understands that. We should not worry too much that we are speaking above the child's level of understanding. Today we sometimes speak above the level of adult understanding. We do not speak above the child's level of understanding if, for example, we say, of course with enthusiasm and with a real understanding of the subject, quote, look at the lower animals, close quote. Let's say that we give the child the chance to see a squid. Then, always using the appropriate terms, we go on to show with which parts of the ideal human the squid is most closely related. The child can quickly understand that the squid is most closely related to the human head. It is, in reality, so. The lower animals have only simple forms, but the human head repeats the forms that find their simplest expression in the lower animals. The human head is only endowed in a more complicated way than the lower animals. What we find in the higher animals, for example, mammals, can only be compared with what we find in the human torso. We should not compare the higher animals with the human head, but with the torso. If we go on to the human limbs, then we must say, quote, look at the human limbs. In their form, they are uniquely human. The way the arms and hands are formed as appendages to the body in which the soul spirit in us can move freely, such a pair of limbs is not found anywhere in the entire animal kingdom. Close quote. If we speak of the monkey's four hands, this is really an improper manner of speaking, since their nature is to serve in holding, in moving the body along. In the human, we see a remarkable differentiation of the hands and feet, the arms and legs. What makes a human really a human? Certainly not the head. It is only a more perfect form of what we find already in the lower animals. What we find in the lower animals is further developed in the human head. What makes a human human? What puts the human far above the animal world are the limbs. Of course, you cannot bring what I have just shown you to children in the same form. You translate it so that the child by and by learns to feel such things out of experience. Then, through your teaching, you can clear away endless amounts of what, for quite mysterious reasons, currently spoils our moral culture. Our present moral culture is so often spoiled because people are so proud and arrogant concerning the head. Whereas people could be proud of their limbs, though they would not be if the limbs were better developed. And this can be proven. Whereas people could be proud of their limbs, though they would not be if the limbs were better developed, and this can be proven. That serve to work, that serve to put them in the world of social order. Natural scientific instruction concerning the animal world can, in an unconscious way, bring the correct feelings about the relationship of people to themselves and about social order into human nature. This shows that the pedagogical question has a much deeper meaning than we generally believe today, that it concerns the great all-encompassing cultural questions. It also provides information about how to teach science to children after the age of 9. You can relate everything to humanity, but in such a way that nature appears everywhere alongside humans, and humans appear as a great condensation of nature. Teachers can give the child much if they maintain this point of view until about the age of 12. Around 12 years of age, an important change begins in the development of the child. At the age of 12, 13, 14, it is different in each child. That which sexual maturity expresses comes into play, namely the ability to judge, judgment. Judgment comes into play and must work together with the reduction in the need for authority. The teacher must harmoniously handle the need for authority and judgmental powers during this age. We must treat the subject material in this way. This is the time when we may begin to bring in those natural, scientific, and in particular, physical facts that are completely independent of humans. For instance, the refraction of light and such. It is at this age that the understanding of how to use nature in relationship to humans begins. Until the 12th year, The child, through inner necessity, wants to understand nature from the standpoint of a human, no longer moralizing, but in the way I just described to you. After the 12th year, the child tends to observe what is independent of people, but it to relate it back to people. You develop something that the child does not forget again when you, let us say, explain the refraction of light through a lens, and then continue on to its application to people, the refraction of light in the eye, the whole inner structure of the eye, EYE. You can teach this to a child at this age. You see, the true curriculum results from an understanding of the stages of human life. The children themselves tell us, if we can really observe them, what they want to learn in a particular stage of life. However, we cannot derive these results from modern natural science. Using natural scientific facts, you simply do not come to the point of view that shows the immeasurable importance of that Rubicon in life that lies around the 9th year, or the other Rubicon in life that lies around the 12th year. We must bring these things forth out of the entirety of human nature. This entirety of human nature includes body, soul, and spirit. Modern science, although it believes itself capable of saying something about soul and spirit, actually limits itself to the body. The way such things are often discussed today, whether to emphasize academics or morality in teaching, whether to teach people more according to their abilities, or to see that they learn more about science because it will be needed later for a job, or so that they can take their place in society. These questions appear childish when we get to know the deeper basis from which education must emanate. How the individual relates to all of human development is not understood by natural science. However, a spiritual comprehension of human development However, a spiritual comprehension of human developmental history does understand it. Let us consider the following law, which is just as much a law as the laws of natural science, but which the methods of modern science do not comprehend. If we go back, you will find these things fully developed in my writings, to the ancient times of humanity. We find that people remained capable of development into very old age. Capable of development in the way that we are now capable only during our early childhood. If we go back to these ancient times, we find that people said to themselves, quote, when I am 35 years old, close quote, or in still earlier times, quote, when I am 42 years old, I will with certainty go through changes connected with the development of my body that will make me into another person, close quote. Just as at the change of teeth, we go through something connected with the development of the body, which makes us into another person. Just as, at sexual maturity, we go through something connected with the development of the body, which makes us into another person. So in ancient times, did people go through such things to very old age? In the course of time, human development has lost this. Today in childhood, we cannot look at an older person and say, to the same extent as was possible in ancient times, quote, I will be happy to be so old someday, because this person has experienced something that, due to my present stage of bodily development, is not yet possible for me. Close quote. The progress of human development is such that we bring a bodily development to ever fewer older stages of life. Those able to observe such things know that, for example, in Greek times still, people in their 30s clearly perceived, as we today in our youth perceive, things not connected with the physical body. Today such perceptions are at most possible for people before the age of 27. In the future this age will be even younger. This is the direction of human development, that the natural, the basic, development of the individual continues only to an ever younger age. That is a fundamental law. Our cultural development is directly connected with this fundamental law. in that reading and writing appear at a particular age, whereas in ancient times they were not there. This is connected with humanity's dependency upon ever younger stages of natural development. Those who can then look further for such clues concerning human development, which we can gain only from an inclusive knowledge, will know how the longings of a Theodor Vogt, a Rhein, a Saulwerk can be satisfied. The current mechanistic orientation of science does not have even the possibility of knowing something like this human life, in which natural development is condensed into ever younger stages of life. It does not have even the possibility of creating a truly comparative historical science that could give clues about how to recognize people's relationship to cultural development. However, those who look further know that people, as they are born, have, of course, characteristics appropriate to their epoch, that they are part of a comprehensive human development. If we develop the aptitudes people already have, then simply because these people are a part of human development, what we should develop is, in a formal sense, developed. If we recognize reality, then much of what causes such a furor today, whether to do things this way or that, becomes only an abstract rambling. This attitude of confrontation resolves itself in a real attitude of compromise. This, you see, is what we would like to develop in the Waldorf School faculty, to create in at least one place something for the future. We hope that the teachers will correctly recognize people and the relationship of people to modern culture, and that they will be inspired by this knowledge, by this feeling, to a will to work together with the child. Then true educational artists will emerge. Upbringing is never a science. It is an art. Teachers must be absorbed in it. They can only use what they know as a starting point for the art of education. We should not ramble on too much about the needs of teachers to have quite specific capabilities. These capabilities are more widespread than we think, only at present they are not very well developed. We need only the perseverance to develop them in the teachers, in the right way, through a strong spiritual science. Then we will find that what we call teaching ability is more widespread than we think. You see, this is connected with something else again. Today, in theory, we are often warned against too much abstraction in instruction, but we still instinctively make these abstractions. It will concern those who see through these things that the plans and ideas for reform, presently so common, will make instruction more abstract than it is now. It will become worse in spite of all the beautiful ideas contained in these reform plans. If we study the stages of human development correctly, first, the long stages up to the change of teeth into sexual maturity, and then the shorter stages up to the development of a feeling of self and the sense of people separate from nature. If we study these epochs correctly, so that we do not tritely define them, but obtain an artistic, intuitive picture of them, then we can first understand how greatly the developing child is damaged when intellectual education is steered in the wrong direction. We should always emphasize the need to educate people as whole beings. But we can only bring up people as whole beings if we know their separate parts, including the soul and spirit, and understand how to put them together. We can never educate people as whole beings if, in education, we allow thinking, feeling, and willing to interact chaotically. We can educate people as whole beings only if we intuitively know what the characteristics of thinking, of feeling, of willing are. Then we can allow these powers of the human being to interact correctly in the soul and the spirit. When people today discuss such things, they tend to fall into extremes. When people realize that intellect is too prominent, that our intellects are too strongly developed, they become enthusiastic about eradicating this imbalance and say, quote, "Everything depends upon the development of will and feeling," close quote. No, everything depends upon developing all three elements. We must develop people's intellect, feeling, and will in the right way, so that they can understand how to let those three elements of life interact correctly. If we are to develop the intellectual element correctly, then during the elementary school period, we must give children something that can grow with them, that can develop as a whole. Understand me correctly, particularly on this point, for it is an important point. Think about it. You develop in children until the age of 14 those ideas that you have carefully defined so the children know how they are to think them. But just through the good definitions you have given them, you have often given them ideas that are quite stiff, that cannot grow with the person. People must grow from the age of 14 to 20, from the age of 20 to 25, and so forth. And at the same time, their ideas must grow along with them. The ideas must be able to grow in parallel. If your definitions are too well formed, people grow, but their ideas do not grow with them. You guide intellectual development in the wrong direction. Then, in cultural life, people will be unable to do anything except remember the ideas that you so carefully gave them. That would be wrong. Children's ideas should grow in parallel with their own development. Their ideas should grow so that what they learned at the age of 12 is, at the age of 35, as different from what it was when they first learned it as people in their physical bodies at the age of 35 are different from what they were at the age of 12. That is to say, in intellectual development, we must not bring them something well-formed and dead, but teach something living, something that has life in it and can change. Thus we will define as little as possible. If we want to bring ideas to a child, we will depict them from as many points of view as possible. We will not say, quote, "What is a lion? A lion is such and such," close quote. Rather, we will depict a lion from many different points of view. We will instill living, moving ideas that will then live with the child. In this regard, modern education does much damage. People must live through their earthly existence. And often the ideas that we instill in them die and remain as soul corpses. They cannot live. We cannot get to the root of these things with the crude concepts developed by modern pedagogy. A very different spiritual impulse must imbue this pedagogy. That is something we strive for in the Waldorf School. We try to give pedagogy a new basis from which to consider such things psychologically. We are completely convinced that an understanding of human beings cannot arise out of the old principles, and that, therefore, these cannot be the principles of a pedagogy based upon psychology. We cannot form this psychology of the developing human with the methods that are so common today. You see, when we can really correctly observe such things, then we throw light on many secondary concepts that we hold to be very important today. We can easily understand them once we understand the main concepts. There is today, for instance, so much nonsense concerning the importance of play in the education of children. In considering the importance of play, we often forget the most important thing, namely that if play is strongly regulated and children are made to direct their play toward a particular goal, then it is no longer play. The essence of play is that it is free. If, however, you make play really play, as is necessary for instruction, then you will not fall prey to the foolish expression, quote, "Instruction should be just a game," close quote. then you will look more for the essential in the rhythm that comes into the life of the child when you allow play and work to alternate. In training the mind and training feeling, we must give particular attention to the individual characteristics of the child. As teachers, we must be capable of forming the instruction so that the child does not simply receive something intellectual in the instruction, but enjoys the instruction in an aesthetic way. We cannot achieve this if the ideas appeal only to the intellect. We can do this if we as teachers relate to the children's feelings in such varied ways that we actually elicit the children's expectations of the subject, which we then fulfill. We can do this if we arouse hopes that, both large and small, we fulfill. If we develop every possible attribute of the children that can play a role in an aesthetic understanding of their surroundings. You can meet the child's aesthetic needs if you bring yourself into a correct relationship to the child's feelings. If you don't tritely sell nature studies, as is done nowadays. Quote, look, there is a mouse. The mouse runs. Was there ever a mouse at home? Have you ever seen a mouse hole? Close quote. Of course, today instruction in nature study is not given in such extreme tastelessness, but similarly. People have no idea how much good taste, that is, the aesthetic experiencing of children, is damaged through what people nowadays call nature studies. We will develop taste only by steering the child's interests to large, inclusive views. For the proper unfolding of the mind, of feeling, taste must rule in instruction and in the schools. Thus we can develop a certain instinct for the essentials in education. The intellect is, at first, the highest mental aspect in each of us. But if we develop it one-sidedly, without a concurrent development of feeling and will, then we also develop a tendency toward materialistic thinking. Although the intellect is our highest mental aspect during physical earthly life, intellect is directed toward materialism. Specifically, we should not believe that when we develop the intellect, we also develop people spiritually. As paradoxical as that sounds, it is nevertheless true that we develop people's capacity to understand material things when we develop the intellect. By first tastefully, in an aesthetic way, developing the sensitivity, the feelings, we can direct the human intellect toward the soul aspects. We can give children a foundation for directing the intellect toward the spirit, only in so far as we practice a development of will, even if we develop it only as physical dexterity. That so few people today tend to direct the intellect toward the spirit can only be a consequence of the fact that the will was so incorrectly trained during childhood. How do we as teachers learn to develop will in the proper way? I recently pointed out that we learn to do it by allowing children to be artistically active. As early as possible, we should not only allow children to hear music, to see drawings and paintings, but also allow them to participate. Besides mere instruction in reading and writing, yes, we must develop instruction in reading and writing from artistic activities, writing from drawing, and so forth. Besides all this, basic artistic activities must take place early in the education, wherever possible. Otherwise, we will have weak-willed people. Directing youths toward what their later work will be comes in addition to this. You see just how necessary it is in modern times that we come to a new understanding of humanity. This understanding can be the basis for a new way of educating, as much as this is possible within all the constraints that exist today. Because modern science does not comprehend these things, we must create something that leads in this direction through the Waldorf School. It is urgently necessary that we do not allow ourselves to be deceived by much of what is said today. A week ago, I tried to explain the significance of the empty phrase for modern spiritual life. Empty phrases come into play particularly in educational reform plans. People feel good, and they believe that they are, quote, very pedagogical, close quote, when they repeatedly admonish others to raise people, not robots. But those who say this must first know what a real human is. Otherwise, this sentence becomes just an empty phrase. This is particularly so when the often asked question, quote, to what end should we educate children, close quote, is answered by, quote, to be happy and useful people, close quote. Those who say this mean people who are useful in the way the speakers find useful, and happy in the way the speakers mean happy. It is especially important that we form a foundation that allows us to understand what human beings really are. However, this cannot be done with the old prejudices of our worldview. It can only come from a new understanding of the world. A new form of education will not develop if we do not have the courage to come to a new scientific orientation. What we see most often today are people who want everything conceivable, but not what is necessary to arrive at a new orientation in understanding the world. We have been searching for this new orientation for years by means of spiritual science. If many people have distanced themselves from it, that is because they find it too uncomfortable, or because they do not have the courage. But what we need for a real art of education can emerge only from a properly founded spiritual worldview. Think about the importance of what the teacher represents to the growing child. Basically, we people, here on earth, if we are not to become petrified in one of the stages of our life, must continually learn from life. But first, we must learn to learn from life. Children must learn to learn from life in school so that in later life their dead ideas do not keep them from learning from life, so that as adults they are not petrified. What keeps eating at people today is that school gave them too little. Those who see through our deplorable social conditions know that they are largely connected with what I have just described. People do not have that inner hold on life that can come only when the right material is taught at the right time in school. Life remains closed if school does not give us the strength to open it. This is only possible if in the early school years the teacher is the representation of life itself. The peculiarity of youth is that the gulf still exists between people and life. We must bridge this gulf. The young senses, the young intellect, the young mind, the young will are not yet so formed that life can touch them in the right way. Children meet life through the teacher. The teacher stands before the child as, later, life stands there. Life must be concentrated in the teacher. Thus, an intensive interest in life must imbue the teachers. Teachers must carry the life of the age in themselves. They must be conscious of this. Out of this consciousness can radiate what lively instruction and conduct must communicate to the pupils. To begin such a thing, teachers must no longer be miserably confined to the realm of the school. They must feel themselves supported by the whole breadth of modern society and how this interacts with the future. A future in which precisely teachers have the greatest interest. Under the present conditions, and despite the present obstacles, we should try to do this in the school, as well as it can be done by people who bring the necessary prerequisites from their present lives. We should not work out of any one-sided interest, out of a preference for this or that, but rather work out of what speaks loudly and clearly to us as necessary for the development of present and future humanity. What in human developmental progress we see as necessary for our time should enter and strengthen instruction through the founding of the Waldorf School. The end of Lecture 2.